Australian True Crime is an independent podcast. If you help us, we can continue creating and improving our content. That's our promise to you. To support us, simply hit the follow button on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. This will help us grow and ensure you're notified as soon as a new episode is released.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to Aboriginal elders emerging.
But you look at these two parties now, and she is on the run with her children back in hiding, and they'll never have a normal life. Police who are involved, they've moved on with their life, they're getting promotions, there probably won't be any criminal investigations. And yes, they've apologised as a force, and they say it was, you know, it was a systemic issue and there wasn't any individual officer at fault. It's just, it still seems inequitable.
That's a voice very well known to Australian true crime fans. It is, of course, journalist Rachel Brown, who is the host of ABC podcast Trace. In season one of Trace, Rachel and one of Australia's most trusted men, retired homicide detective Ron Iddles, reinvestigated one of his old cases, the unsolved murder of Maria James. Maria was the single mother of two sons, one of whom was profoundly disabled. He disclosed to her that he was being sexually abused by the parish priest, and she planned to confront the man on the morning she was murdered. I won't spoil it for you in case you haven't heard it yet, but suffice to say that by the time Rachel and Ron were done, the Victorian coroner announced there was to be another inquest into the 38-year cold case of Maria James. After such a great outcome from that first series, Rachel Brown could have done just about anything with the second. The easiest thing in the world would have been for her to make another series about a cold case. She could have found another beautiful family. As we know, there are unfortunately lots of them in similar situations. And she could have looked like a hero again. But that's not what she chose to do. Rachel Brown chose instead to help Lawyer X, Nicola Gobbo, tell her story. And whatever you think about it, it's certainly a bold and exciting choice for a journalist to make at this moment in her career. The first person to ever accuse Nicola Gobbo publicly of informing on them to Victoria Police while also acting as their legal counsel was none other than disgraced former drug squad detective Paul Dale, who joined us earlier this year. You may or may not recall that Paul was charged by our friend Charlie Bazina for the murder of another police informant, Terry Hodson, in 2004. It was drug dealer Carl Williams who accused Paul Dale of asking him to help with the murder, and the key piece of evidence against Paul was a recording made by Nicola Gobbo of a conversation between the two of them in which he allegedly admitted to asking for Carl's help. So when Paul discovered that the recording existed, he accused Nicola of breaching their client-lawyer privilege. She argued that she'd only ever spoken to him as a friend. He and Vicky Petratus wrote about it in his memoir in 2013, but they had no idea at the time that they were so close to uncovering the Lawyer X scandal. Here's what Paul Dale had to say to us in March this year about his memories of that time.
When I was originally arrested for the murder, I was remanded in custody, and then I can't remember how long it was. I think it was certainly in the next week or two. We're preparing for my bail application. Tony Hargraves, who's a very prominent criminal barrister who the police association use, and hence any serving police officers or police officers that have any issues also have to use him. Tony came and visited me out at the Acacia Unit Bowen Prison. We're in an interview room, visitor's room type thing, and he tells me, well, I couldn't believe it. I'm like, well, at that stage, all I knew that she'd tape recorded me and made a statement. Look, yes, I knew her professionally.
Yeah.
Personally.
Yeah.
And
yeah, you were mates.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got to be mindful there because they always try and use that fact that I knew her socially was, she was never providing him with any legal advice, you know, and that's the thing they've had to run, you know, the defense they've had to run all the time because they knew if it got found out that she was giving information against her own clients, which is now has been found out, but back then clearly they had a real major issue because they had had her informing for some years, which, yes, as you said, I had no idea about that. But so to find out, Nicola Gobbo, this was the most high-profile criminal barrister in our state at that time. You did not pick up a paper or watch the news without seeing Nicola Gobbo representing Tony Mockbell, Carl Williams, or any number of high-profile criminals coming in and out of the Supreme Court or the courts. She was known by us at the drug squad to be the person to go to get you bail.
And that's why you went to her?
And that's why I went to her from the very start.
You weren't directed to her?
No.
By anyone?
No.
You just went, you went to her?
From the very first time, yeah. I was arrested back in the Dublin Street thing and I was read my rights and we got back to the Ethical Standards Department and it became quite clear to me through the interview that, hang on a minute, there's more to this. You know, it came clear that Hodson has made allegations and whatnot. And I thought, no, well, actually, I think I do need to speak to a lawyer. Nicola Gobbo was the person I called. And then she attended upon me and then attended upon me at the bail, you know, down in the cells and continued to assist me over the next number of years. Clearly, unbeknownst to me, she was a police informer and unbeknownst to all her clients at the time.
See, that's the moment I would have thought this is something huge going on here.
Look, I went tingly, yeah, actually, when you said it, and I know my voice has probably changed because the hairs do go up in the back of my neck because it's at a time when you're at your lowest mentally. I've been completely isolated. I've been picked out of the APCO service station, which I operated and ran as my own business for a number of years at that stage. I've got my child and my wife back there. I'm there at work early in the morning. 20 police cars turn up after they flew in a helicopter up there because this is how important it was to arrest Paul Dale in dramatic scenes and go from there straight from being remanded there, straight down to Bowen Prison, straight into this isolation unit. There I am in a bright red jumpsuit, all zipped up, shackled. And placed in this tiny little 2.5 by 2.5 meter cell and left there for 6 weeks. Now, Tony came and see me within about the 2 weeks and we were going to make a bail application. And that's when he told me about Nicola Gobbo. I guess the full story doesn't come out for some time, obviously, but it was incredible. And all I did was I remember standing up off the chair and walking around and Tony sitting there and, because no one could actually physically get near me other than a lawyer back then. Mind you, she'd visited me in jail as well.
No and way.
Yeah, so she'd visited me in the when I was first remanded back in 02, 03, whatever that was. She visited upon me as my lawyer And I gave her a number of documents that I'd been sitting in my isolation unit at Port Phillip, and I'd been given access to a pen and paper. And so I was making all these notes in regards to, you know, Hodgson, Michel, you know, the Operation Gallop and all the things that, you know, that I say, well, these go to show that I couldn't possibly be involved in that. I gave that all to her. She took it straight to her police handlers and gave it to them. Now, if that's not legally professional privilege breach,
there's no clearer.
I mean, she signs in as a lawyer. She comes and visits me as a lawyer. Nicola Gobeau-Dewar offered to act for me in a pro bono sense, and that's, you know, a lot of people ask me, why would a high-profile criminal barrister ever do it for free? Well, she did it for a lot of people for free, believe it or not. She was really trying to be the person in the scene. And so to have, and my case was quite high-profile as well, even back then. She wanted to be the person to be seen doing all these high-profile matters. That's the way I saw it. Now I look back, now I know she was targeted. She was told, get involved with this bloke, get involved in any of these cases, get all the information you can, and we'll work out whether we'll disclose it, use it, or whatever. But it's not for the police to do that, because once you come to court, the obligations on the prosecution are to provide all the relevant information. And I think it's goddamn relevant that the barrister that people are using is a police informant.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Thanks to the Geelong Regional Library Corporation, I had the opportunity to talk to both Vicky Petratus and Rachel Brown a couple of nights ago about the two subjects of their latest work. In Rachel's case, it's series two of her podcast Trace, The Informer. And in Vicky's case, it's an updated re-release of Paul Dale's memoir, Cops, Drugs, Lawyer X and Me. Now, Vicky and Rachel are anything but disgraced. In fact, they're both quite famously scrupulous and meticulously professional operators. So I had to start by asking them what attracted them to these two characters, who most people are happy to write off as inveterate liars and narcissists.
So the word disgrace that you just attached to Paul Dale, I, and everyone listening will understand, if you're a lover of words and books and stories and storytelling, words hold a lot of power and can do a lot of damage. And as Paul Dale would argue, the fact that his that disgrace got attached to him will haunt him for the rest of his life. I was interested in Nicola Gobeau because I felt like, this is before I reached out to her to be involved in the second podcast, that she had become almost a caricature, that she wasn't a real person. We heard she was a slut, a narcissist, a treacherous bitch. You know, she snorted cocaine with her clients, she slept with cops, and all these words and these ideas were attached to her. But I was interested. I'm like, oh, we've never heard from her. You know, I wonder how she would respond to this. And I don't know whether that was me as a journalist or me as a woman or me as someone interested in the gangland era. And I was fascinated by why. And that was the first question on the TV interview that ran in December. Why would someone who she was on track to be a QC,
yeah,
an SE, why would someone gamble that, their livelihood and their life potentially taking on these dangerous criminals? So I wanted to hear it from her. And I think that that's really important. And there'd be a lot of people that I think might be critical of me. And I have read some reviews saying that, you know, I've let the podcast lets her play the victim. I was interested in hearing her story because we hadn't heard her story yet before the ABC got her. So the podcast pretty much does what it says on the tin, that it's her story in her words. But we also obviously tried to round that out with people who would have spoken against her. That was really tricky too, because certain crims, cops and lawyers would sledge her to me and I'd be like, great, okay, this is good, I need this, let's tape it. And they'd be like, oh, no, want nothing to do with it. So it was really hard getting a well-rounded perspective of her, but I still think it was really important to tell her story. And I had massive second album fears after Trace One.
Yeah, bit.
And that probably might answer your question about why I changed tack, because I kind of thought, I'm a perfectionist, I'm very stubborn to my own detriment. And I just thought, God, to beat Trace One that had sparked a new inquest, I'm going to have to maybe solve it, like solve the next one. And I didn't really want to go in after being exhausted after Trace One with that kind of pressure on my shoulders. So it was a mixture of those two things marinating me, thinking, well, how do I raise the bar? And so I thought maybe it's better that I change tack, kind of like what Serial did. And I changed tack to this because I thought, you know what, Maria James was an easy woman to like.
Yes.
Obviously, yes. You know, everyone was sympathetic to that. So this was more of a challenge for me as a journalist, not because I wanted people to like Nicola Gobbo, definitely not. She did a lot of things. She's to blame for a lot of things, undeniably. But I wanted listeners to see the person behind the punchline.
Rachel, I must admit that the first couple of episodes I was getting wild. I was wild. I was saying to myself, what is Rachel doing? Why are you letting this woman just talk her crap? Because by that stage I was firmly in the camp of everything that comes out of her mouth is rot. She's a liar. But then I started thinking later along the lines of what you're saying tonight that, well, hang on, there's actually plenty of people presenting that story. And what I've never actually heard is Nicola's version of all of these events, her story. I'm also intrigued by the fact that I know the two of you have had a great relationship for a long time. You are friends and you've respected each other's work for a long time and you've supported each other for a long time. Vicky, you've been really passionate in presenting Paul Dale's version of events, who's another person who most people say, oh, don't listen to a word that comes out of his mouth. He's full of it.
Yeah, I think Rach and I have known each other for a long time, and I don't think, Rach, you knew that I ghost wrote the first book, did you? Because I remember it didn't seem like that long ago that you rang and go, did you ghost write that book?
Yeah.
And I thought it was really important for the first book to, it was in his words, and I thought that he needed to have that book for him. And all along, I think, for me, it was never about these salacious details, and I was really careful in the book and in my own research that I didn't ever want it to be about whether they had an affair. And I think this is because it wasn't relevant. And I think even just watching, I was watching again that Sky special on her, and you've got all these men talking about her, and she's the, you know, she's the, I think they called her the puppeteer. And you've got, you know, she slept with so-and-so and she was this and she was that. And I just think, oh, for goodness sake, this is about so much more. And I thought there's going to be a whole lot of, largely men, I don't know, you might agree, Rach, but largely men judging her for sexual activity. This is about, and it was always about, Victoria Police using unscrupulous and unethical methods to gain convictions. And that was why I wanted to take on Paul's story, because for me it was always about if they did this to him, if they paid off witnesses, if they offered people no sentence or a life sentence like they did with Terry Hodson, what would people say? And so for me it was always about the process. So if Rachel thinks that Nicola slept with Paul twice and Paul's admitted once, that was never going to be an issue.
No, but there are very much more important details than that at stake. I mean, for one thing, Paul contends that he was receiving legal advice from Nicola. She says, no, it never was. And that's a really crucial point in terms of his life and the way his life has panned out, because if she recorded him while giving him legal advice and then passed that recording on to police, well, that's a very important breach that has happened to him. So it's not just salaciousness.
Yeah, I think with Paul's story, it was always when he was the lone voice, as he was when the book came out in 2013, he was the lone voice saying, what happened to me, the process of what happened to me, was just plain wrong. And when Lawyer X came out, I think when it became such a much, much bigger story affecting so many people, I said to Paul, I think now your story has a context. And at that point, you were the lone voice saying, this isn't fair and it's not right the way Victoria Police acted. And then all of a sudden, he was one of many saying the same thing. So for me, it was, that's what it was about. That's always been at the core of this story, is that if we live in a system that is supposed to be as fair as it can be and just, and what I saw happen to him, and that book was never written about, it wasn't him saying to me, and this is what happened. He came to me right at the start and he had a ute full of boxes and he just said, you read it and you decide, you tell me what you think. And the minute you start reading it, you know, I think I sat there going, oh, my God, no, they couldn't have done that. And so really it wasn't, it was an examination of the documentation that as a citizen I was shocked, and that's what hopefully the book reflects.
And I think, Rachel, you mentioned something a moment ago that really requires discussion, and that is the difference in reportage when it comes to Nicola as a woman. Mm. And just in researching for this conversation, I found a report in the Herald Sun from earlier this year in which there's an issue in the Paul Dale story about a burner phone. And I won't go into why it's important because it's very complicated, but, you know, a burner phone, of course, is a phone that we have that isn't attached to our names that we can use for various purposes. Now, some people believe that that was attached to a murder, actually. But Paul Dale says, oh, no, I had a burner phone so that I could have affairs with police women. That's his sort of alibi for having the burner phone. And I've only ever heard that story once. And I had to go digging and digging for that story and read it once. Nicola, on the other hand, has this constant narrative, doesn't she, about her sex life. And as you said earlier, about she's a slut. She had an affair with this one, with that one, and it went for this long and it was this many times. And let's talk about that, about the difference in reportage and the effect that it has.
Yeah, I noticed that a lot, but I didn't want to be, I did worry about taking this on because, and some people have actually said that in reviews, that of course, you know, you'd defend her because you're a female journalist at the ABC. And I find that really offensive. I'm not an apologist for Nicola Gobbo. I think she stuffed up. I think she had exits and she didn't take them, you know, and I'm sorry to be crass, but I'm not going to defend a person just because I'm a woman and she's a woman, so therefore I'll jump to her defence.
But we can't ignore that either. That disparity is extraordinary, and you cannot read a story about her without reference to her sex life.
And I did a count, and in the early days when all this stuff about her sleeping with cops, I counted 5 cops in the space of 8 years. So it's hardly a deluge.
Yeah.
And cops that have got in the witness stand, I know for a fact, have had affairs, you know, with other lawyers or journalists, and that was never brought up. So there is an imbalance there. But I also think, and you might find this interesting, that she's such a bolshy character and can be so on the nose that I think that worked in the police's favour a bit, because she took all the attention and she was like, you know, with a magician and misdirection and look over here and you don't see what's going on. She was that look over here, you know, she was the misdirection and her sex life. And so I think she's been, again, I'm not saying she's blameless. She's got a lot to be sorry for. But I think that helped that, you know, people who were also to blame were just rubbing their hands together going, beauty, like the attention's on that. When, you know, this did not happen in isolation. One woman cannot corrupt an entire justice system. Her use was facilitated by Victoria Police. It was encouraged by VicPol. So we need to be talking about that. So absolutely. I'm actually really glad. Thanks for telling me that you were yelling at me at the start. It's nice to hear, but I'm glad that, because I knew this would be a slow burn, this podcast, for people to be work out what I'm doing. And I wanted that vacillation because I've done that. I've been like, oh, I feel a bit sorry for her here. And I was like, oh, no, how could she do this? And I've vacillated the entire time. So that was what I tried to infuse in the podcast, that very difficult human being to put in a pigeonhole.
But you're right. At the same time, I read today that Simon Overland has a new job. He's about to head to Tasmania to head up a council there. Stacey Bender, who is a viewer, has a question. She's asking, what is the ideal perfect outcome for the Royal Commission trial, all the people involved, including the corrupt police. Now, the reason I raised the name of Simon Overland is at one time he was very high in the hierarchy of police, and he was one of the people in the stand on a number of days when everyone was pointing fingers and saying, whose idea was this and who was running this and who was the most senior person to know about this? And I don't know if we even really got an answer about that. But certainly the commissioner has said that no police will face charges, right, at the end of the Royal Commission.
So the Royal Commissioner, Margaret McMurdo, has said that she won't name anyone. Right. So this was really interesting. So Counsel Assisting wrote a 2,000-page gargantuan and blistering report into all of this, quite impressive, and they did name names about people they suggested that the Commissioner could find may have committed criminal offences. And the Commissioner decided to redact all those names and said, you know, it might prejudice potential future trials. Mm-hmm. So I can see it from her point of view, but to answer the viewer's question, makes it very tricky because now who does it? Victoria Police probably won't investigate itself, and therefore then the next best thing is IBAC, the corruption watchdog. And IBAC has already come out and said, well, you can even think about pursuing individual officers for potential criminal offences, we would need double our budget and we would need souped up investigative resources and powers. So it's looking more and more unlikely that no charges will be laid. So then what have you got? You've got a $40 million Royal Commission paid for by taxpayers, and that's not including the Victoria Police Bill, the money that they've spent on lawyers and documents and all that jazz. So I'm really sorry, I can't give you an answer because I'm struggling with it myself. I actually don't know what will happen, if anything.
And I think this is what is really sad about this case, is that the handling all along is almost guaranteed. How can they go back now? And how can they go back now fresh? It's just been so corrupted in every way that how do they... Will they ever get answers? I don't think they will.
Well, I guess we still have to go through the process of the people who are now appealing their convictions. How long do you think that will take, that process?
Oh, that's anyone's guess. You know, I think there are 8 men at the moment appealing their convictions. A couple of them are coming up for bail apps soon. You know, they want to be allowed out while they appeal. That's a lot of money. And then some of these guys will then try to sue the state of Victoria. I was talking to Vicky earlier about this, actually. There's a guy called Simon Illingworth, a corruption investigator, whistleblower, sorry, and he did an interview with Josie Taylor, my colleague, and he said something really interesting. He's like, well, they deserve compensation. You know, even if they've, like a lot of people might think that they've done the things that they're in jail for, but if they haven't been given a fair defence and a fair hearing and gone through the system correctly, Simon Illingworth said, in my mind, they are innocent. And they deserve compensation.
Yeah.
This is going to cost Victoria a lot of money and a lot of time.
And what a great time for Victoria to have this problem to spend money on. John Cleary is one of our viewers, and he asks, is there any difference between Lawyer X's protestations and those of criminal Catholic Church priests and brothers, specifically paedophile priest Vince Ryan on Revelation, in that they both seemingly refuse to admit their criminality? Which is a very complicated question with many, many, many levels. I don't even really know where to begin with that question. Nicola, has she been convicted of any crimes? Not that I know of.
It's, again, I think if you put that question, if you say Nicola Gobbo is in the same category as a paedophile or a paedophile denier, I think, again, that, and Rachel knows more about this than me because you sat there for the Royal Commission for that year, but I think when you've got so many people all acting outside of the law for their noble corruption or however they wanted to justify it, and I think then to say it's all Nicola, I think is underestimating the breadth of this. And I think that Nicola needs to stand alongside all those senior police officers that were there all the time, all along, having weekly meetings about this. And again, Rach, you hit the nail on the head when you said they're all getting promoted and where's she?
Well, not only that, I firmly believe that at least one senior homicide detective ultimately left Victoria Police because she believed that he knew that she was informing, and he didn't. But I believe that she was rattled and that she orchestrated or certainly was part of orchestrating his leaving. You know, so not only were other police being promoted, but great cops were leaving because of these shenanigans, because they weren't in the tent. They didn't know what was going on, and so they weren't included and they ultimately left.
That is another sad thing, that a lot of them are so bitter. You know,
yes.
Some of the most blistering statements at the Royal Commission that I've read are from Sol Solomon and Cam Davey, two lead investigators on Petra. Sol Solomon is still serving, so for him to have written that statement while still serving, I was kind of in awe, actually, that he was brave enough to do that. But Cam Davey, I think, is now with IBAC, I think. But he wrote an equally blistering statement basically saying that Victorian Police, in trying to hide its use of Nicola Gobbo, effectively nobbled the Hodson murder investigation and nobbled any chance that those Hodson kids will have of justice. And that's one of the most powerful lines of the Royal Commission in my book.
Yeah.
You can see former homicide detective Charlie Bezina in our next live stream event on Saturday, October 10 from 7 p.m. For tickets, you'll find a link on our Facebook page, on our website, AustralianTrueCrimePodcast.com, and at nottoodeep.com.au. Thank you so much to our patrons, and hello to all of our new patrons who've saved 10% by taking out an annual subscription. Thank you, Taylor O'Brien, Charmy Zielinski, Chilean Tierney, and Melissa Pepper.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Coming up on Australian True Crime, Rachel tells us more about her long days in the press gallery at the recent Royal Commission into the handling of police informants. It's brought about a very dark period for the Victorian organisation.
Where to, do you think, from here for Victoria Police? It's been a really bruising affair for them, hasn't it? And that's a real shame for them. And I know they have a new commissioner, but it's going to be a very difficult road back.
It's a really, really tough one because I've got mates who are cops, some who worked in that era. And Josie, there was a line in the last episode when I was chatting to my colleague Josie, and she's right. She said a lot of them genuinely thought they would, and still think they were doing the right thing. They thought they were trying to solve crime. Nicola thought she was helping. I know this sounds bizarre and I'm not an apologist for her, but I do think they all genuinely believed that they were doing the right thing. But you look at these two parties now and Nicola Gobbo is on the run with her children back in hiding and they'll never have a normal life. And that's her fate and that's her price. And I, for the record, I don't know where in the world she is and neither does her lawyer. But police who were involved, as Vicky mentioned, they've moved on with their life, they're getting promotions, there probably won't be any criminal investigations. It still seems inequitable. And yes, they've apologised as a force and they say it was a systemic issue and there wasn't any individual officer at fault. And they also say procedures have changed and this could happen, never happen again. I really struggle with that because we just have to take its word, right? Like there could be other lawyers that are informers that we'll never know about who have their own particular set of Like, it will be a completely different story. Like, one woman, so much money has been spent on a royal commission on one woman, when every informer has a different set of procedures that cops are following.
Well, am I the only person who feels like I feel like I keep reading and hearing hints that she's not the only one?
When I interviewed her, she said she knew of two others. So are we going to have royal commission into both of them?
Can I play devil's advocate, as I generally do in this conversation, and try and really, really take us all back to that time and place, though? Because I do think that with this space, we tend to forget as a community how intense that time was and how frightening that time was. And particularly when we reached that point when Jason Moran was shot dead in Tarago at Auskick, in front of not only his children but hundreds of other children and families, the pressure that was on Victoria Police and on the state government to make this stop, there's part of me that can understand the ends justifies the means mentality.
Oh, totally. Yeah. It's so easy for me to judge. I completely, you know, put my hand up to that. There was a really great witness in the Royal Commission called Paul Rowe, and he basically said, we're damned if we do, damned if we don't, because if we found out about a $15 million ecstasy import and we did nothing about it, there'd be an inquiry as to why we potentially let hundreds of people die from ecstasy. So you're right, Michelle. It was, they were struggling and they were losing and they needed a secret weapon, and that was her.
Paul Rowe's evidence was fascinating, wasn't it? Mm. Because he was saying, you know, he got that information from Nicola Gobbo about the world's biggest ecstasy hall. Remember that, coming into Melbourne? And he was like, "What? Am I meant to ignore that? Because she's breaking her vow or her ethical position." He's like, "That's not my problem. I'm not letting down her clients. That's, you know," and I really related to what he was saying. He's like, "I'm a copper. Shouldn't I act on whatever information I get?" And Vicky, we have this conversation, it seems like, over and over again about drug squad detectives. We're not speaking specifically about Paul Dale, but drug squad detectives time and time again can end up in trouble, and there seems to be a lot of reasons for that, but one of them tends to be you're trying to get information a lot of the time from people who work in the drug industry, right?
Yeah, I think that was part of Paul's problem, was as a detective, and not just in the drug squad, but as a detective, that promotion was based on how many informants that you could source and get on the books. So part of their job to go out and meet with all sorts of people and try and get intel from them, that's where you got it. But going back to your point, the end justifies the means, and I've heard that over and over again by serving police officers and as an excuse, the noble corruption
idea, right?
And I actually say, okay, well, let's unpack this. The end justifies the means. What is the end? And as Rach pointed out, this has cost $40 million just for the Royal Commission. Now, I thought I was being kind of overly generous when I estimated in the book that this will cost the taxpayer all up, including the Royal Commission. At that stage, the budget was $30 million. But it will cost us $50 million and it will release prisoners that may or may not have done what they were convicted of into the community. So when you start hearing the end justifies the means, ask yourself, what is the end? Because the end is a circus, a very expensive circus, where I think, can we trust the people at the top? And I think that's going to be an issue for all of us. Can you trust Victoria Police? I've got friends that are in the police force too, and they are amazing people, but is there an argument, Vicky,
that we've almost overshot the runway, that the end could have been effectively the end of the gang war? We could have left it at that, essentially, and nobody needed to know all of this stuff was the back end of how that happened. And the people who are in jail, can't they be there? Weren't they bad people doing bad things?
But we don't know, and we have these processes.
Don't we?
Like when Margaret McMurdo opened the Royal Commission, and she said a few really, really good things. One, she said when people can consult a lawyer, whether they pay, whether as a friend, and I thought that's specifically for including it, Paul. But, you know, she talks about we have these processes for a reason, because they have been judged the fairest and tested year after year. And it is up to no one to come along and say, well, you know, I mean, a lawyer isn't supposed to dog on her clients, but the end justifies the means. And it's like you can't, you've got to get them fair and square or not at all. And I think all had convictions where, you know, the public, not knowing half the information, has gone, oh, that's a bad conviction and he was definitely guilty. But it's like we have these processes. If they are elastic, then everyone's in danger. And I know, Rachel, that, you know, that your last episode of the podcast and wondering whether or not police could bug a phone without a proper warrant or whether they could spy on. I certainly had times when I was working on Paul Dale's book where I heard really strange clickings on my phone. I had some really weird experiences where my sister, who was living with us at the time, she thought she heard us come home from work and called out, and then she heard the door downstairs close. And I don't know what was happening, but would it surprise me if I was under surveillance? Not at all. And I think that, you know, can they overstep marks? Could they bug my phone? I'm the most boring person ever, and they wouldn't get anything, but did they? And I think we need to trust in our police force. And at the moment, I think working on this story really rattled my trust. And I've been writing positive police stories for 25 years about all the wonderful work that they do, but this is not one of them.
No, well, you can both attest to the fact that through this process, we've discovered that to protect the secret of Nicola Gobbo being an informant, a lot of things were done that we would never have believed would have been done. Things happened that we would never have believed, right? What's shocked you, Rachel? What's left you shook?
What we were just talking about, actually, I was just trying to find a note in my little notepad, and I found it, and I made a note to myself, and Vicky was touching on this then. It's, you know, it's easy for us as a society to look at it and say, well, you know, they're gangland, they're thugs, it's no big deal. But the minute you accept that, that blurs the line for everyone else. Mm-hmm. You know, it robs the Hodson kids of justice for their family. And that is the worry, that in their desperation that police possibly started behaving like the people that they're trying to stop. You know, so once we start accepting that blurred lines, as Vicky said, it has trickle down effects for society. And yes, they might, some of those people might deserve to be in jail, but we need to play by our system, right? That's our rule of democracy. That's our fundamental tenet, that everyone deserves the right to a fair trial. And I don't think you can mess with that. And I'm pretty unapologetic about that. And some of these guys were very dangerous criminals, but yeah, you just can't mess with the start, because it's then what about if you're charged with a crime, Michelle, and, you know, and cops bend the rule a little bit, then, you know, it's like boiling frog. You know, you just get that death by degrees.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I know there are plenty of people who think I'm a bad person, but there are plenty of people who think I'm not. So it's like, who is the judge? It just depends on who you get on the day, doesn't it? So that's why we need actual written down laws, not just a person who gets to reckon it. Jody Skinner would like to know, Rachel, if you've heard from Nicola during the process. No, you don't know if she's listening or you haven't heard any feedback.
No, so as I said in the podcast, the last time I heard from her, the last time she called me was around the time that's in the last episode, when she was going through customs when she came back into Australia in Brisbane. And then the eerie time, potential phone interception in her lawyer's office, that was early this year. And so that was, I thought, well, great, I can put some questions to her lawyer and fill in some gaps. So not since then. And that was very strange. The phone line cut out, and then her lawyer, Tim Tobin, went across to check if she'd emailed him to say, oh, my phone's died or something like that. And there was an email from her saying, I think they know who you have there, as in me and Josie, in his chambers. That freaked me out. You were asking me if anything should, that really, not to be melodramatic, but that gave me chills. And then his computer died. It just crashed. Went back to factory settings, you know, choose your language, Spanish, Italian. His PA said she'd never seen anything like it before. It was asking for his office database codes. And this is a Vic Bar computer. So that was really worrying. And I walked away and I thought, have I been doing this for too long? Am I paranoid? You know, am I jumping to conclusions? And this is exactly what the Royal Commission was about, you know, police interfering in that sacred
lawyer-client communication. So I went home and I thought, no, it just must be a terrible coincidence. But Tim Tobin reached out to his IT technician, who said that it looked like his computer had been accessed and shut down remotely. Oh. And that to me is quite, I found that quite chilling. I didn't get to put any questions to her that day, and that was early this year. Tim Tobin reached out to Victoria Police and said, have you been interfering with my communications? And they, to give them a right of reply, he called him back and said, no, it wasn't us. We can't do anything like that. So that day is still a mystery to me.
John Cleary, who is watching, says the just a few bad eggs excuse offered time and time again in every failure of governance, banking, aged care to cover rotten culture, which survives despite royal commissions, and the halo effect being removed temporarily. Now, I think what he's getting at there, and correct me if I'm wrong, John, but I think maybe is the idea that the royal commissions give the impression that they've had a big broom and swept away the bad eggs, but then doesn't feel like there's some firm closure to come out of these things sometimes. You've both sort of commented on that.
This is the first time we had a scandal. I think we're always a bit smug in Victoria because New South Wales seemed to have so many different scandals, and we had our window shutters. Remember that? Operation Bart? And people were, I don't know, claiming kickbacks from broken windows or something like that. And it was like, gee, if that's the worst Victoria Police can do compared to what other people could do. And I think when this hit, it wasn't a couple of bad eggs in a police station, or it wasn't a particular CIB or the drug squad. This came from the very top, the highest office in the police force. And people, Overland knew, Ashton knew, Cornelius knew, they all were a party to what went on, and none of them, I think Ron Eddles seemed to be the only one that just went, hold on a minute, no, this is wrong. I don't care why you're doing it. This is wrong. This is dangerous. And I think that's it. Whether it's a culture, I don't know. And as we said before, a lot of those people are being promoted. So I don't know that they're sweeping out. Nicola seems to be the one that's suffering here.
Well, I don't think she's the only one. I think we've mentioned a few other people who have continued to be vilified, frankly, for their not joining the club sufficiently.
And it is, you raise an interesting point there. The culture of going the line, one particular thing that I heard at the commission really stuck with me, and the days could be quite drab, so if something stuck, it was quite poignant. And it was Tony Biggin, and he was running at the time the source unit that looked after informants. And he said that Officer Black, which is a pseudonym, who did the report into whether or not Nicola should be turned into a witness, so private informer into a public witness to testify against Paul Dale. And he said, you know, no, bad idea, could lead to a death, could expose our secrets, could expose methodology. And Biggin was saying that he, in the end, had to then stick up for Tony Biggin because he said if he submitted a report like that, and if Sandy White did, another key handler, they would have a black mark against their name for the rest of their career. But that stuck with me because I thought, God, this is someone, and the council assisting picked up on that. He was like, hang on, so he will have a black mark against his name for warning Victoria Police that their informer could be murdered. And Biggin said, yes, he would have. So I felt nervous for him having to hand over that report, so I stuck up for him. And that's telling in an organisational perspective, I think, that officers feel like they can't speak up. It's get on the train or get under it, was Simon Illingworth's view of that. And he thinks that that culture still persists today.
I think so, and I think some retired police are still suffering from that culture today, frankly. Anonymous attendee, it sounds like it's going to be a really juicy question, but it's not anonymous. It's just, I don't know the full details of the Nicola Gobbo story, but from what I've seen, she appears to always want to portray herself as a victim. No doubt there is some truth to this, but she doesn't appear to take any responsibility for her own misdeeds. What's your sense of her in this regard? And obviously, Rachel, you're the person who's spent the most time not only with her, but certainly just listening to her. You must have heard her telling her stories 100 times by the time you've gone through the process of editing and putting this thing together. So do you get any sense of a level of responsibility that she accepts?
I'm really torn on this one. She probably doesn't accept enough, but she does accept some to a lot. You know, she's admitted that she passed on privileged information. I feel like with her, and I've been criticised for this, there's always a but. Yes, I did this, but it was related to a future crime, so I was allowed to do it. Or yes, I did this, but someone could have died. Or yes, I did this, but cops kept circling and coming back and wanted more and more and more. You know, I wanted to pull back and they kept using me. So there's always
a threat to take my children. This is controversial, but I must admit in that episode I thought, well, yeah, I sort of understood. Surely there is an argument for at least investigating the safety of her children. I mean, she is in hiding from, she says, Victoria Police, but certainly from gangland figures, right? I mean, she's been messing with Calabrians, for crying out loud. Like, isn't there, if she refuses police protection, she says it's because she doesn't feel safe in that environment. But surely for police, isn't there an argument to say, listen, if we have a witness in this situation and we're offering her witness protection, she won't take it and she has small children. Mm. We have to call investigators in to see if the children are safe with her. I felt like in your episode you were backing her up and saying, oh, this is terrible to do this to a mother, but I'm at home doing my dishes in my kitchen as a mother thinking, well, nah, I think her children are in danger with her.
Yeah, okay, so let's talk about this. So I asked on this a lot. I don't have kids. Stacey's got kids.
You don't need to have kids to think about this. I'm not saying that, by the way.
Yeah, oh, no, I know you weren't suggesting that. So, yes, this is really tricky because I would, on the face of it, yes, I would be worried about the kids because I would be worried about her. And then the more time I spent with her, she's like, she doesn't feel in danger. She thinks that she's more useful to some of the criminals alive because she could be their ticket out of jail if they want to appeal their convictions. So she feels like she's more in danger from cops. So why should she join a protection program that cops run? And then her argument is she feels like she'd be safer living in plain sight. And then she said to me, you know, at the height of the gangland war, when people like Carl Williams and Jason Moran were being actively hunted and shot at, that Victoria Police never interfered in those gangland families. You know, Vic Pohl never said, perhaps we should take Jason Moran's kids away. And Jason Moran ended up getting shot in the front of that minivan with his three kids in the back. So then you come to, well, that's a good point. They never did that. And Josie's like, yeah, but that's also, to play devil's advocate, perhaps they should have because they were in the car when he got shot. So it's a really tough one. And I just came back to, well, yes, Victoria Police, it doesn't sound like they did interfere in other families. So that did make me wonder whether she was right in thinking that they're just using them this time to, you know, they would prefer she's hidden away in silence so she can't say any more to embarrass them. I can't give you a straight answer on this because it's really complicated.
And it's a really, I never even thought that far through it. That's a really interesting question. Why weren't they looking into those families? Mm. Because, yeah, it does seem obvious that those children were at risk, doesn't it?
And I guess, like, if someone said to you, it's just really tough. I don't know what I would do, whether I would stay and fight and risk losing my kids or whether I'd give in and go back into hiding. I feel really sorry for the kids and I feel sorry for the Hodson kids. And it's a good kind of juxtaposition of how intergenerational this gangland war is. You know, this happened 20 years ago. The Hodson kids are still suffering. Nicola's kids will never really know a normal childhood.
Yeah, that conversation was one of those moments where to my ears I just thought, oh, gosh, she's delusional. But you've helped me to accept that, you know what, I am really conditioned to listen to her that way. Mm. So you have helped me to understand that I have listened to years of descriptions of her and never had the opportunity to listen to her. So I think it's a really valuable document, this podcast, in that just as your book, Vicky, is a valuable document because we have heard so much about these people and it's valuable to at least hear their versions and be able to make up our own minds. There's plenty about them and there's plenty of testimony from other people about them.
Everyone has the right to tell their story. And when you are silenced, whether you're male or female, when you are silenced, I think that's when I become interested, because if someone's trying to silence you, or I think it's really important to give people a voice. And I think also it makes other people more careful because they never expect Nicola to have a voice. They didn't expect Paul Dale to have a voice.
Thanks again to the Geelong Regional Library Corporation. They're hosting the Word for Word National Nonfiction Festival online this year from November 20 to November 22. so we can all get involved no matter where we are in the world. Thank you to Vicky Petratis, author of Cops, Drugs, Lawyer X and Me, which is out now, and Rachel Brown, presenter of the podcast Trace the Informer. Every episode of that podcast is up now, and we deliberately didn't talk much about the last episode, which is an absolute doozy. So don't muck around. Get to it. Thank you to patrons Ebony Ryland, Vanessa Gordon, Janice Bryden, Aim B, Kate Stevens, Simon Holmes, Michelle DeLamar, and Del Guy. And thank you for downloading Australian True Crime, made in association with the Acast Creator Network. We'll be back next week. And good luck, Nicola, wherever you are.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.